Many of the main elements to the 100,000 Lives campaign have become key National Quality Forum safe practices. A leader's blueprint to chasing zero.
The safe practices are a roadmap. There's no need for every hospital to reinvent the wheel. These are practices that have been proven. There's a strong evidence base. They can be implemented in every single hospital immediately.
Leading organizations such as the Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Vanderbilt, Catholic Healthcare Partners, and Brigham and Women's Hospital are working with TMIT to validate the financial business case for adoption of the safe practices so that leaders will greenlight investment in safety.
For boards and administrators, I think the greenlight approach will help them justify the hard decisions that need to be made about investing in changes that are going to tangibly improve safety.
We have some great action lists for leaders, like the National Quality Forum Safe Practices. That is, we know what to implement. So far, we're approaching that as a matter of volunteerism. We're saying, please do this. We know it works, saves lives, reduces injuries. And ultimately, we're going to have to mature, I think, to the point where a safe practice that's well known is no longer an optional matter. You have to be safe because we know how to do it and we owe it to our patients.
It's an honor, really, to be a part of authoring and NQF Safe Practices. What I really appreciate is that they're involving patients.
You have saved life.
Because patients are a part of the healthcare team, an often unused one themselves. And so it's really great that they're involving patients in the process.
Mr. Quaid, to understand what happened to your twins, you had on the screen a picture of the two vials. I do have them right here. They look very, very much alike. The one that was 1,000 times more was the one that was administered to your children. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Not once, but twice over an eight-hour period.
Not once, but twice.
Yes. Now, how could this have happened? Well, the answer became very clear to us after talking with the doctors and nurses and doing a little bit of research on our own. The 10 units of Heplock and 10,000 units of heparin are deadly similar in their labeling and size. The 10,000 unit label is dark blue, and the 10 unit bottle is light blue. And if the bottles are slightly rotated, which they often are when they're stored, they are virtually indistinguishable. Now, since this brush with tragedy, my wife and I have found out that such errors are unfortunately all too common.
Since our accident, the labeling on the vials has dramatically changed. Our twins, Zoe Grace and T. Boone Quaid, are already protecting other kids and saving lives.
Get up, Sammy.
While my wife Kimberly and I have been on this journey, we've had the privilege of learning about many other families who have gone through similar tragedies.
Braxton, he always had a smile, and he just, you know, he loved life.
He was putting in the time and the dedication. He'd spend hours at the stairs. Dad, throw some pucks at me. Dad, you know. And I think the difference between an athlete and a professional athlete is their heart and their dedication. And I think Braxton could have been one to take it real far.
Now let's go back to the beginning. Braxton needed the surgery for sleep apnea. Was Braxton worried?
He always put on a tough face, but yeah, he was concerned. He was very worried.
What did you tell him?
That he was going to be okay. And it wasn't true. We brought Brax home from the hospital, and everything seemed fine. You know, he wasn't complaining much of pain. You know, he was resting, and he watched some TV, and we sat with him, watched some cartoons, and about 4 o'clock, he said, "Dad, I'm hurting." So I gave him his pain medicine, and everything seemed all right. He fell asleep, which seemed normal to me, and he woke up at 7:30, and he said, "Dad," he said, "you know, my chest's hurting." I'll never forget that, you know, I sat and just comforted him, and I asked him, "Brax, are you all right? Are you in pain? Do you need something for pain?" And he said, "No, Dad, I'm fine." That's the last time I saw him alive. We went months and months without any answers from the medical examiner. And, you know, all we wanted to know was what happened to our son.
The Rells went for 4 months without answers. And then they were forced to seek legal help. The system failed them. 13 months after Braxton's death, all they had was an autopsy report sent in the mail.
When I went to get the medical records, I was given 2 or 3 pages, and I was told that they don't keep anesthesia records and nursing notes. And it just didn't seem right to me. So I talked to some experts and was given some advice on how to get the complete set of medical records, which I did. You know, it really erodes your trust and it makes you fearful. You know, you think that you would have answers right away when something adverse happens to your loved one. It's been 13 months and we still don't have all the answers.
And so you don't have closure?
No closure at all.
You know, a lot of time I think that lawyers get involved, and the hospital's lawyers get involved, and the focus seems to be on risk management after an accident occurs. And not to say that, you know, they weren't doing everything that they could to right the situation, but as a human being, felt that the last thing I wanted to do was focus on legal issues and somebody's liability about it.
You know, the last thing we wanted was to hire an attorney just to get the answers that we should have had all along. The NQF Safe Practices states that hospitals and caregivers should reach out to families after an adverse event. Without any type of communication, it makes us feel that, you know, Braxton didn't mean anything to anybody but us. And, you know, you just can't, you have to communicate. You know, it's the most important thing there is.
It's understandable that a hospital reacts the way that they do, because it is a business, and there is liability involved. Yes, and they have to protect themselves and protect that entity. But what happens in the end is that a lot of times the problem winds up not getting fixed because a lot of things get swept under the carpet. They don't want people to talk. They don't want the nurses to talk. They don't want the staff to really talk. So the investigation into what happened is stifled.
For Sue, preventable harm struck her family not once, but twice.
Shortly after Cal's injury, my husband Pat had a pain at the base of his skull and his cervical spine. They removed actually a tumor from the base of his skull, sent it to pathology. The surgeon came out when my husband was in the operating room, and he shared with me that it was a benign tumor. And 6 months later, my husband was in pain again. We got another MRI, and it was discovered that Pat had a mass the size of the surgeon's fist.
The final pathology report from his initial surgery indicated that Pat had cancer. This misplaced path report was yet another error that shattered the future for the Sheridan family, ending Pat's life prematurely.
We, to this day, still don't know what happened to it. It appears that it got filed in my husband's chart without anybody seeing it except for the pathologist. Pat underwent 5 more surgeries. They basically removed his spine. He became disabled, so I had a son using a walker and a husband using a walker. But after about a year and a half of treatment, Pat's cancer came back explosively, and he woke up paralyzed one day from his waist down. And they shared with us that he had about 10 days to live. Pat had always told me that if he was going to die from his cancer, he wanted to die with family and friends and a bunch of really good wine. And he, after a long, long pause, said, I want to go to Disney World. He said, I want to watch my kids and my family have the time of their lives. And so after I collected myself, I picked up the phone, I called Disney World. And within 4 days, 53 of us flew to Disney. They put the kids in parades. They sent up Minnie, Mickey, Pluto. It was truly a celebration. On the third day, Pat died at Disney World.
One of the biggest barriers to getting to safe care all the time, everywhere, is fear. We're trained, if we make mistakes, not to come forward, that this is something to hide and feel badly about. And sometimes people are punished when they acknowledge mistakes. A very powerful lesson gets learned immediately when that happens.
Kimberly and I put ourselves in the nurse's shoes. I'm sure that no one wanted to harm our kids, but it's human error is a part of the system. It should not be criminalized. All it's going to do is alienate the very people that we're trying to bring in to help make things better.
I wanted to work as a nurse and with babies since I was a little girl. In 1990, I graduated from nursing school. I had four little babies. Up until about 4 years ago when this happened, my life was full of babies. On the 4th of July, I worked double shift, and we were busy, and it was almost 1 a.m. before I was able to kind of wind down and leave. And I lived a long way from the hospital, and I decided I was too tired to drive home, and I needed to be back in a few hours to do the day shift I was scheduled for. And so I laid down in a patient room on a patient bed and tried to sleep and got up to start the next day. And at 9 o'clock, I met the patient. She was just a very young 16-year-old girl, and she was so scared. The plan was that they were going to break her water and start some Pitocin, and she was going to deliver her baby.
Julie followed nursing unit guidelines designed to improve readiness of patients for anesthesiologists to give an epidural injection. She adhered to the checklist of the guidelines and prepared the anesthetic medication at the same time that she had antibiotic medication ready to go. A number of systems flaws contributed to Julie's absolutely predictable human error.
So I got her IV, her antibiotic, and her epidural bag. Both bags had ends that received IV tubing. I had her antibiotic in my hand. I knew that. But I didn't have her antibiotic in my hand. I had her epidural medication in my hand. And after it started running, I heard a sound and turned to her bed, and she was already resting. People came to the room immediately, many, many, many people. Dozens of people who were familiar with both of those medications that we used. Everyone saw that hanging there. I just hung this antibiotic, and I think she's reacting to the penicillin. And then someone cleaning the room found the bag. They brought it to me, and they were crying. They put it in my hands. It didn't make sense for a while, and I kept looking, and then it just crumbled.
Julie administered the wrong medication. Fatigue, identical medical tubing connectors, similar IV fluid bags,
and a suboptimal barcode process all spell death for the young mother. The hospital fired Julie. She was criminally indicted. As a single mother of four and with no resources to defend herself, she had to plead a misdemeanor to avoid prison. What happened to her led to the development of the new National Quality Forum safe practice called Care of the Caregiver.
Well, the Julie Tao story is really a tragedy because she was hung out to dry for making a mistake, which was clearly caused by a whole host of very bad systems. She was truly the second victim in two ways. She was the victim of bad systems, as well as being emotionally a second victim. She was devastated by her error, as anyone would be. But in addition, she was the person who was the victim of these bad systems. And the lesson, I think, is not just that hospitals need to be responsible for their systems and fix them, which is clearly what they need to do, but there's a second lesson here, and that is Julie Tao was fired, she was indicted, she lost her license because she was presumed to be incompetent. There's no evidence that she was incompetent. No evidence was ever produced that she was incompetent.